Today's podcast is brought to you by Every Wednesday, a plan to inspire the people of Portland and support the place we call home. Let's get out of the house and spend some time with each other. Skip Zoom, meet for coffee, take your colleagues out to happy hour. Buying a gift? Ditch the internet and support a local maker by shopping in-store. Head into town every Wednesday and see what's going on at everywednesdaypdx.com.
Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
I often think that I was pretty lucky to have made it through my teens and 20s mostly unscathed. I was a very, maybe dangerously enthusiastic experimental drug user and a very committed party girl. Many times I popped a weird pill or smoked a weird bowl or even sniffed a weird dust that was handed to me from someone that I barely knew or just met or only trusted because we had like two acquaintances in common. And in the 90s and early aughts, it was never in the front of my mind, I mean, except for maybe in the case of heroin and crack, that a little light experimentation might result in immediate death. But things have changed. Nowadays, not only is an Oregon teenager's first dalliance with recreational drugs very likely to secretly contain the deadly opiate fentanyl, preventative measures like life-saving interventions, addiction treatments, and just basic recreational drug education are essentially unavailable in our state. Looking back, if I was a teenager under these conditions, frankly, I'm not sure I'd be alive. It's Saturday, March 18th, and this is episode 115 of The Dive. Today, I'm speaking with Emily Green, the author of this week's cover story, which originally appeared in the Lund Report, Generation OD, which unpacks a terrifying rise in youth fentanyl addiction, overdoses, and deaths, as well as the painfully neglected dearth of drug education, resources, and recovery services for teens and young adults. Emily and I will discuss her findings in one sec, but first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. The Washington County Board of Commissioners voted unanimously March 14th for the county's housing authority to negotiate the purchase of Woodspring Apartments, an affordable housing unit bought by a San Francisco investment firm who was anticipating the expiration of rent limits when the project's 20-year affordability period ended. Margot Black, a tenant advocate who organized and rallied the residents, notes that other properties may be in for the same fight, as thousands of affordable units across the state see their affordability periods end in the coming years. Anthony Effinger reports, Synthesis Institute, the Dutch company teaching students how to guide clients on psychedelic mushroom trips, ghosted students 4 months into the year-plus online course. Retreat Guru, which operates an Expedia-type service for self-improvement getaways, has taken over the Synthesis curriculum. Many students have filed complaints against Synthesis with the Oregon Department of Justice. Jolene Adams asked readers to submit their film queries to Portland's iconic video rental store Movie Madness. And next time you think there's nothing to watch, I implore you to bring up this article and think again. And then thank Jolene and Movie Madness in the comments. Now let's chat with Emily Green about her groundbreaking reporting in this week's cover story, Generation OD. How did we get here?
If you look back, you know, providers and researchers have been warning state officials about this for a long time. As far back, maybe even earlier, but as far back as 2008, I found a report from DHS. The Governor's Council was involved, a couple of provider groups. They did this big report on addiction services in Oregon, and they identified then adolescent treatment as a top area of need. Mm. And they also pointed out that prevention programs were lacking, they weren't consistently applied. And so that was one big report. 2 years later, the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission gave a report to then Governor Ted Kulongoski, again pointing to the lack of treatment designed for teens and young adults, called it a significant gap. Mm-hmm. Nothing was done. Then 2017, here comes another big report, this one from the Oregon Substance Use Disorder Research Committee. And they come to the same conclusion, resources for detecting or treating adolescents with substance use disorder in Oregon are minimal, they mm-hmm. wrote. And at that time, Oregon ranked 48th in the nation in terms of adolescent access to treatment. Now, at that time, when we were 48th in the nation, we had 144 residential treatment beds mm-hmm. for youth. That's a lot more than we have now. The pandemic really ravaged the youth treatment system, just like every other, you know, healthcare system in our state. And those numbers started going down. We had about 120/20. And as of December last year, we had 31.
What?
And it even got as low as 13 beds.
What?
Last April. And that's, 13 beds. For, you know, nearly 300,000 adolescents across the state. It's really, really astounding.
How does this happen? How do we go from over 100 beds to 13 beds?
There's a number of factors that have contributed to this. The workforce shortage is a big one. Some providers in Oregon have been actually trying to expand their youth treatment programs. Managers at Morrison Family Services told me how they tried to they offer a lot of mental health services, and they wanted to have a substance use disorder program that was commingled with their mental health program for youth, which is a huge need in our state to be able to treat kids that have both mental health and substance use issues. They hired some staff. They were ready to roll it out. They posted an opening for a supervisor for that program. They needed a level 2 alcohol and drug counselor. They had that position open for over a year. They could not find anyone to take that position. And so they ultimately had to abandon the program.
Oh, wow.
And this is happening to providers across the state. I also talked to Erica Fuller. She's the director of Rimrock Trails. They have an inpatient co-occurring youth program in Prineville. She's licensed for 24 beds. But she's only able to take 7 kids at a time due to staffing issues. And so they were never able to reopen their girls' facility. They're only able to take boys right now. And this is something we keep hearing. And there's a couple reasons for this. For one, the reimbursement rate is too low. So when people bill Medicaid, they get a certain dollar amount to reimburse them for those services. And for a long time, that just hasn't come close to covering the cost of care for substance disorder treatment. Now, lawmakers have increased that rate by about 30%. That hasn't gone into effect yet. So that will help. But providers tell me it's not enough. It's still not going to cover the cost of care. And meanwhile, other costs are going up, right, with inflation and worker wages are going up in other sectors. Another problem that's emerged during the pandemic that Erica Fuller at Rimrock Trails was telling me about is a lot of certified alcohol and drug counselors have moved over to telehealth. You can work fewer hours,
sure.
You can work from home, and you can make more money doing that work. And you can take patients that are lower acuity. So it's, you know, potentially a less stressful job. So there's a lot of competition for workers in this space.
What did support for youth addiction look like, say, 10 years ago?
You know, I asked Heather Jeffress about this. She's the director of the Oregon Council for Behavioral Health. And she said back in the 90s, the state had around 120 to 160 beds. And that at that time, it seemed to be an okay level. Things weren't at the, you know, crisis level that they are now. But then as time went on, that number just never grew, even as Oregon's population grew by more than a million. And then it got to that point, and then it just started to hit that steep decline.
How are these kids getting their hands on this drug? I mean, I know that in the story it mentioned that a lot of kind of like street drugs, party drugs are being cut with fentanyl.
Well, I interviewed a student at Harmony Academy, which is a high school for teens in recovery over in Lake Oswego, the only one in the state. And he had a pretty bad fentanyl addiction that he actually thought was an oxycodone addiction until he went through a toxicology test. And Whoa. He always obtained the pills through Snapchat. And he said that's how kids are getting them. Mm-hmm. I've heard this from parents. I've heard this from, you know, other news reports as well, that social media is really where a lot of dealers are finding kids and kids are finding drugs.
Mm-hmm. I also read that Oregon is one of the strongest states in the country for prevention research. So I was wondering, why aren't programs that are designed in our state more prevalent in our state?
That's a really good question. I talked to Anthony Biglin. He's the senior scientist at the Oregon Research Institute, and he's been studying prevention for 30 years. And
oh, wow.
He said the gap between what Oregon knows and what it implements is vast. And you know, he had the same question. Why isn't Oregon implementing more of these programs? And going back to that, you know, those reports that I talked about, they all, you know, pointed to prevention being an area that's lacking, and we just haven't really seen anything substantial come in and replace, you know, the bygone dare just say no kind of method of,
yeah,
you know, prevention that we all know now doesn't work. There are some, I talked to the Oregon Department of Education, there are some requirements. Each grade, junior high through high school, is supposed to have like at least some prevention. It's usually worked like a chapter in a health book or incorporated into another class. There are a couple grades in high school that weren't getting that required prevention, so they're rolling out some prevention related material into like language arts, social studies, to try to fill that gap. But providers say we need something a lot more substantial than that.
Mm-hmm.
Things that get at the root causes, you know, make decision-making skills and interventions that the school can be involved in. There's this like pre-contemplative, you know, stage of drug use where education can be a good intervention, just letting kids know, you know, what it's doing, what the drugs are doing, what the risks are. And that's something that schools aren't doing. And I talked to the principal at Harmony Academy, Sharon Dursey Martin, and that was her suggestion, that schools really start, you know, getting more involved in educating kids about some of these risks, because a lot of kids, it's not going to rise to the level of needing treatment or a recovery high school if you can do a better job of early intervention. You know, those are kind of the last resorts once a teenager has really developed a problem.
Yeah. Is this Anthony Biglin, is this the same who's the chair of the prevention subcommittee?
Yes, yes.
So he mentioned four programs, mm-hmm, with a proven ability to prevent a range of behavioral problems. What are those programs? And is one of them the recovery high school?
No, these are programs that are, they're not specific to substance use disorder, because they really look at decision-making skills and all those other things that end up being root causes of, you know, substance use disorder. There does need to be some sort of education element, and especially around fentanyl. I talked to John and Jennifer Epstein. Their son, tragically, when he was 18, home for the holidays, from his first semester off at college, he ordered a counterfeit oxycodone off social media. And before doing that, he actually Googled, what is the safe dosage for my weight? What is this? And looked to see if Oxycontin. Looked to see if it had any kind of interaction with his anxiety medication. What he got was not OxyContin, it was fentanyl, and he overdosed and he died. But just his actions leading up to that show that, you know, it's likely if he knew that that could have contained fentanyl, his parents believe, you know, he might not have taken that drug and he would be alive today. And we know that Oregon teens don't know the dangers. There was a survey done in Central Oregon just this past November, so not very long ago, that looked at high school students and surveyed them. And 91% said they knew little or nothing about fentanyl.
Oh, my God.
And 95% knew little or nothing about counterfeit pills.
Oh, my God.
Just how a lot of these, you know, unknowing overdoses are occurring. So I think another strong example of how education might be able to help is the Beaverton School District. So the Epsteins, after their son passed away, they just kind of, like, dropped everything and started dedicating their lives to spreading awareness. And they're doing a lot of this work through an advocacy nonprofit, Song for Charlie, also founded by parents of a young person who died of a fentanyl overdose. And they worked with the Beaverton School District to develop a program called Fake and Fatal. It involved lessons in every single junior high and high school classroom, a social media campaign, a town hall for parents. It was virtual, like more than 6,000 people attended, which is huge.
Wow.
More than 40,000 have watched since then.
Wow, awesome.
And they also got naloxone, which is an opioid overdose reversing drug, into classrooms in the district. So leading up to when this program launched in April of 2021, there had been 4 fatal overdoses in the school district of students. And since the program launched, there have been 0.
Wow. How many children have died?
Well, back in 2018, there were 4 deaths. In 2019, there were 5. And then it shot up to 16.
Oh my gosh.
In 2020, and then up to 27. And these are all drug-related deaths, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But fentanyl was responsible for like 80% of these overdoses.
Oh my God.
But if we look just at 2021 alone, we don't have all the numbers. You know, if we look at the most recent data for 2021 alone, among teens, or I looked at 2 age groups. The last numbers I gave you were teens 15 to 19.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at ages 15 to 24, 73 young people in that age range died from fentanyl just in 2021 alone.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
That's a lot of young people. That's a lot of families, you know, who lost a very young person in their life. And, you know, every time that happens, it's, you know, a tragedy that really reverberates with those family members and friends for years and years.
Absolutely. And just to think that these deaths could have been prevented with some education.
The state did put together a toolkit. It came out last year, you know, 3 years after deaths started surging due to fentanyl, that they have made school districts aware of that they can use to teach kids. But the issue with this is that neither the Oregon Health Authority nor the Department of Education, which created this toolkit, I asked both agencies, neither of them are tracking which districts are actually using it and which ones aren't. So there needs to be, it would appear, you know, a better method for figuring out where the education gaps are.
Yeah. How has Measure 110, how has the decriminalization of hard drugs contributed to this crisis?
You know, how a lot of folks want to point to Measure 110 and blame it for all of problems around substance use we're seeing in Oregon, but we had a couple things happen at the same time. We had fentanyl arrive and we had the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
which contributed to substance use rates across the country going up. So we can't say this is because of Measure 110, because this is something that's not unique to Oregon,
mm-hmm.
but there is an unintended consequence of Measure 110 that was pointed out to me by Tori Lynn. He's the director of the juvenile department in Linn County. So with Measure 110, you know, possession of small amounts of drugs are no longer a misdemeanor. They are a civil infraction with a $100 fine. You can either get the fine or go through an assessment. Well, for youths, there was another piece of legislation around fines and fees that prohibits punitive fines being placed on youths for things like that. So with youths, there is no $100 fine. There is no consequence. And that was one method that, you know, we had of getting kids into treatment, because in Oregon, there really isn't another method. And now Tory Lynn, he didn't suggest like, oh, we need to recriminalize this. And in fact, nobody I talked to said we need to recriminalize this. But the problem is that there isn't a good referral system. Like, how do you connect the kids who are using to the treatment system? Obviously we need a treatment system to connect them to in the first place. So this is a two-pronged problem. We have typical teen experimentation, right, that we all, I'm sure, remember from our youthful days. Sure. And then that's changed, you know, but the teenage brain hasn't, that risk-taking nature. So you have kids who are taking one pill and dying because they don't understand the risks, and just because there's so much of it in the supply now. I mean, there's a huge supply side issue with this problem that my article doesn't really get into, but I think there's more room for journalism on that.
Big thanks to this week's guest, Emily Green, and thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again next week. Until then, bye!